insures risk at a higher level. You've got the $1,000 deductible that's the responsibility of the enrollee, much like they have currently under Minnesota Care. Then you have this $3,100 deductible, which is self-insured by the state for up to $2,100 in eligible expenses per year. And we also have sliding fee scale premiums, just like those currently have under Minnesota Care down at the very bottom. I'm going to try to put this in a way that helps you understand how this saves so much money. Right now, we're paying $500 in Minnesota Care for these adults, $500 per member per month. That's $6,000 per year. Under this model, you've got the major medical, which doesn't cost as much because it's insuring risk at a level above $3,100 in deductible. So it doesn't cost a lot. The state is helping pay that, the members helping pay to the extent they can. And then you have $2,100 promised to pay per year. So you've got either $6,000 that you're going to spend under the capitated model right now, or you've got a maximum of $2,100 per year that you're going to spend under this model, plus the premiums for the major medical. And you begin to see how this model is set up financially to provide coverage and save a lot of money. I also want to address, I think some of you received an email from the Citizens Federation. I know they're a single-payer group. Charlotte Fisher is actually a woman I spent a lot of time talking to about these things. This email has a number of false assumptions. The assumption is that we're into 80-20 coverage under the major medical. That is not true. In-network, it's 100% coverage. So again, this is better coverage than they're currently getting under Minnesota Care. And we're paying hospitals, we're paying providers, commercial rates, and we're able to do that because of the way this works in terms of the private insurance market, private underwriting, underwriting risk as opposed to prepayment of health care. So the model works. I know that my colleagues here who have been working on this committee for some time went back to the drawing board, really did their homework again. We heard Representative Thiessen ask the question. Well, we think 70% of these people will be underwritten in Canada. We studied our facts once again, and we believe firmly that the 70% is an extraordinary number. It's more like what we would see from the general assistance and medical care population, a very sick population. So we are confident that the 30% that we're using for our projections is actually a conservative number. John Tyler here can tell you in a moment, his group underwrites a number of people who come off of Minnesota Care. So for income eligibility purposes, they're no longer eligible for Minnesota Care, but their health situation is still the same. And I don't know, John, I don't want to speak for you, but very few, if any, of those are ever underwritten in Indiana. So we already have some experience in the private insurance market with the people we're talking about covering, the Minnesota Care people, and we know that they are not being underwritten at that significant level. So this fear that we're going to throw 70-80% of these people into MCHA is simply wrong based on the information we have. And even with that, we know that our projections are to save tens of millions of dollars. I know the Department of Human Services right now seems to think that only saves $4 or $5 million. We're still talking with them about the methodology that leads to that. But we think this model is a way to provide sustainable coverage for these people in need, low-income people. We're talking right now, again, about 55,000 people currently covered under Minnesota Care, so it's really a demonstration project. This is not throwing open the gates to everybody on public programs. But we think if we take the adults without children on Minnesota Care and we use this model, we can show that it provides great health care coverage to them, that it pays providers and hospitals reasonable rate and avoids some cost shifting, which is a very important part of this, provides some portability of the product, still does a great job by the member, and saves the state money, which we desperately need to do. We all know that sustainability of coverage is a very important part of this. We've got our health care access fund is not going to be able to cover the programs we've got right now, perhaps by the year 2014, at which time state law says we have to start disenrolling people. So we have to think about sustainability and ways of actually saving money as we cover people. And Mr. Chair, I'll stop my comments there. Hopefully we'll have some time for questions here, too. I know there's a few people who want to testify yet. And then, John, we'll bring you other things to add.
Great, thank you, Mr. Chair. John Tyler with the Minnesota Association. association with the health underwriters. The legislative committee that's been doing this analysis for some time now. I just would like to underscore and support what President Caldwell is saying here about returning to the basics here as far as providing coverage is concerned. That the way the individual market in this case was doing, we simply always did was simply go to the rate book, the rate chart of a combination copay and deductible plan offered by Medica, but Blue Cross Blue Shield also offers one very similarly as well. To really look at options here and look at what the current costs are in a way that we can help subsidize the necessary insurance for the 80, but it doesn't hurt anyone in the process. And that is simply going back and looking at what are we doing for the private sector anyway, right now. And what we did is we tweaked that major medical plan offered by Medica called their solo plan. And to add maternity as any other illness and to add prescription drug coverage as into the major medical portion of things. And so we looked at what the average cost would be for this particular population as a standalone major medical product as compared to current. And the answer to that is even adjusting for the FCHA enrollment we're dealing with, a figure not greatly off of $200 per member per month on average, as compared to approximately $500 per member per month on average. Looking at that, we said, well, some of those are going to go to the MCHA, we know that. And so we took to various percentages. It's well greatly exaggerated from what we actually experience in the marketplace right now. Blue Cross Blue Shield enrolls 85% of those that apply for their coverage. That's not we tweaked that and upgraded that to 18%, now finally to 25% with this population. That's still greatly in excess of what we expect is going to happen as far as the population is concerned. And so I think suggesting that perhaps having an income of less than 250% of poverty level equals adverse health is just not consistent with our experience. We get people enroll up and down Minnesota quite routinely. That's just not a big deal. These are just folks. Our efforts to try to further enhance the plan have been to introduce a health reimbursement life arrangement, or a HRA or HRA life account, only for using a government trust for government insured individuals, to further upgrade coverage. In other words, to introduce the self-insurance mechanism that we have talked about here, to take and supplement for those that need it to a healthy degree, it covered that $3,500 out-of-pocket limit called the HRA that may or may not be spent based on an as-need basis by the average enroller on a first-dollar basis. So the individual needs to go through the $3 copays, need to go through the various copays on prescription drugs, etc., before they really have, and the HRA, before they really have any out-of-pocket expense. So we're really hedging our bets in favor of the insured here as well. They also are suggesting that a comprehensive vision plan, a comprehensive dental plan, is not out of the realm of reason here. But each of these needs to be looked at individually. Should we include an HRA with this? Should we include a dental plan with this? Should we include a vision plan with this? I just think that given that what's on the table is a demonstration project here, I think that we have reason to believe we can be optimistic about offering a very, very comprehensive level of benefits and still save the state money.
Mr. Tyler, what would, in the major medical part of this, what would the pharmaceutical coverage be?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a good question. But the insurance coverage itself it covers the first $2,000 per year on the insurance portion of the plan. There would be a copay of $5 for generic drugs, a copay of $50 for brand name drugs, and a copay of $90 for non-brand name drugs. That would be supplemented by the HRA account. So what we have is the HRA account supplementing the $5 copay, if it's a generic, the $50 copay if it's a brand drug, or a $90 copay. So the net cost to the individual would actually be zero for that initial part of it. Those are the first $2,000 on the insurance contract. And then that's when the HRA would take over for the next $2,100. The individual between a combination of prescription drugs, doctor's visits, copays, out-of-pocket expenses, and such, could have a total of a $3,100 out-of-pocket that is, again, supplemented by the HRA account. Once we go to the major medical plan portion of the plan, once the individual has exhausted that $1,000, the major medical coverage in network is 100% coverage, and including prescription drug coverage, up to $5 million major medical maximum. Out of network would be 80-20, in network would be 100%.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tyler, when you dispute the 70% that would be going into MCHA, what percentage would you say instead of 70%?
I think our most recent analysis was 25%, but the original analysis we did was 18%, which even of itself is higher than what we see in the marketplace as a whole. But we're using 25% right now, and that we're still looking, according to our calculations, using the most recent census information provided by the Department of Health, looking at even with the comprehensive dental and vision and HRA plan, still looking at an $18 million projected savings, according to our calculations, even assuming the same rate of losses for those that go into the NCHA program as exists today. That's an important part of our calculation. So we're taking into consideration in our analysis as well.
Mr. Chair, if I could add to real quickly, there's been some confusion about what happens if they end up in MCHA. They will get exactly the same package in MCHA. There's not the model we're setting up says that they would get the same thing in MCHA that they would get if they were not underwritten in MCHA. So this is meant to provide parity coverage. We're not leaving the state holding a greater bay. We're not hurting the enrollee more by doing this. It's a mechanism that works extremely well in Minnesota. Other states should probably be following our example more with that. And it has allowed us, I think, it's a big part of the reason Minnesota has the highest percentage of people covered in the nation, is that the MCHA mechanism works. We don't want to break that. We want to help strengthen it.
Just as a follow-up, I wanted to ask, where could you identify the waste in Minnesota care that makes this plan such a much better idea?
Mr. Tyler.
Mr. Chair. In my opinion, the waste is that we are using at present a bit of an obsolete model, I might say. The capitated model simply fixes a rate of payment to the health plans and says, take it as yours. Reimburses providers at the medical assistance rate, and there's really nothing that varies. There's no mechanism of self-insurance if the claims are less, there's no mechanism there at all. To look at that. We're looking at a guaranteed issue type of model that says people fill an application, they come onto the Medicare program. There's no part of that is actual risk management. Whereas in this model, there's very definite risk management on the front end. That's called health underwriting. That people are screened via health, either accepted the client or rated based according to health, which allows the insurance company to set premiums and acceptance according to risk. That model is using the MCHA is the Minnesota Care version of guaranteed issue, because if they be rated or declined, they have the ability to enroll on a guaranteed issue into the MCHA. And so that mechanism is what is different about this, the risk underwriting aspect of the plan versus a guaranteed issue capitated model that is a better capitated in my opinion.
So then, just as a follow-up, when you say you set premiums and acceptance according to risk, that you're assuming then everyone's premiums would be different. A fairly healthy person premium would be less. But what do you mean by that phrase, set premiums and acceptance according to risk?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi, if I could simplify it a bit, what we're saying here is instead of prepaying health care, that's what we're doing in the capitated model. We're prepaying all health care. The risk we're talking about is the risk that we're separating the state from by using a major medical. You have to blow through $3,100 plus $2,000 of prescription drugs that we're self-insuring through the state before you get to the major medical. The private insurance industry looks at that and says, if you have to blow through that much money before you get to the major medical, we're not going to charge very much for this, because the likelihood of you getting into the major medical is dramatically reduced. Under the capitated model, you're right into it. It's the full bore. You're capitating for all health care coverage. So dollar one is already starting to be captured under that payment. And so you're prepaying health care as opposed to the risk. Sometimes when we say we're insuring against risk, it sounds like we're saying we're putting people away or putting them aside because they're risky. And that's really not what we're talking about. What we're saying is that's how the large deductible being self-insured lowers costs. Because the major medical keeps you whole on the benefits. But we're self-insuring for that the $2,100 or $3,100 beneath that. So you have to go through all of that to get to the major medical. And the insurance industry looks at that and says, well, much like your car, if you have a high deductible on your car insurance, you're going to pay less for it. Because the insurance company looks and says, you're going to pay a lot out of your own pocket or somebody else is going to pay through it through self-insurance before you get into using this. And so we're going to lower the cost of that because there's less risk of us having to pay up under that. But it doesn't insulate people from, it doesn't prevent people from getting health care. It doesn't put people at arm's length. The risk we're talking about is the risk of having the insurance company pay out under that major medical. Now, if we only had a $500 deductible, that major medical plan would cost more because the chances of you using up $500 and getting into the major medical is much greater. It's much greater. I hope that helps.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Gutwell, I think sometimes that understanding of that $500, what you get for it, but right now you pay it no matter what. And I think the savings or the difference is that $500 is if you do nothing for that patient in that month, you still get $500. And the next month, if you don't do anything, you still get that $500. And so that savings is in taking a look at what you actually need versus just paying for something. And so I think the savings to me is within that, I think for us in the state of Minnesota, getting what we actually do pay for versus just paying for something, whether we get it or not. And what I like about this is going from 10,000 up to 5 million. I know that the uncompensated care is a huge issue, and the compensation for our providers is a great big issue, and it's all tied in together. And this kind of, even if everything else were the same, but when you get the 5 million cap, but I think the secret is in that $500 that we're going to instead pay for what we actually get instead of just paying whether we get it or not or need it or not. And I think it's the difference between that two devices is a real key here. And I think structuring that in this proposal, you structure that so you can capture that savings for the state. But the exciting thing is our clients, these consumers, actually get better care, too, and our providers get appropriate compensation. You know, it's not if it were just the one thing, but it's those three together that really makes this a very intriguing and I think a very acceptable kind of concept. I think they're getting better all along the way at presenting it, but I think you really got to understand is what's really happening right now or is not happening within that 500.
Chairman, my name is Greg Seiler. I'm president-elect of Mahu Health Underwriters of Minnesota. There's been a lot of talk about overloading MCHA with a bunch of unhealthy people. I speak for the broker community here. We're very, very protective of MCHA. We feel that MCHA has been a wonderful tool. Our job is to ensure people and get them covered, and MCHA has been a wonderful safety net for that, funded by the state. So in our modeling, we have been very, very careful watching this to make sure that in our numbers we would not overfund MCHA. And if we did see that, we would stop promoting this because this is a very important piece of our healthcare industry in Minnesota, is MCHA. So I want to try to put your minds at ease on that. We do not fear we're going to be overloading MCHA. And I think John's estimates of 25% are still actually very, very conservative, actually being high. I think it'll be lower than that.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being before us again so we can ask questions. I have a couple. First of all, when I looked at the bill and the Healthy Minnesota Plan on page 4, it seems like mental health isn't in the list of covered benefits, and I'm wondering if that's an omission or where that's considered a contributor.
Mr. Chair, it's a good question, and we've talked about as the bill comes through. Keep in mind we have a DE1 that we haven't been able to attach, and even though none of that we haven't attached yet, I understand that. But when you take it as a whole, we have talked with others, including Legal Aid and some others, about actually laying out every single bit of detail about the coverage, because we understand that's a concern for people. But keep in mind, this is meant to be at least Minnesota Care coverage. It's covered currently under Minnesota Care. It's covered under this plan, plus. And we have additional coverage beyond that. So if mental health is currently covered under Minnesota Cure, it's covered under this package as well. Maybe John can speak to that more, Greg, but we've got this sheet too. I don't know if you have it or not from your previous package, but it actually lays out what we're currently doing under Minnesota Care, what's proposed under this plan, and then what it ends up looking like to be enrolled. And we'd be glad to share this with anybody who wants to see it, but it really shows that the benefits are identical to us in Minnesota Care.
Mr. Tyler.
Sure, thank you. Representative Murphy. Mental health and chemical dependency coverage are just built into the base rates of the drug base contract.
Representative Murphy.
I had a question about the premium. So how is the premium set? And then is there any control over the cost of that premium to the state as we move forward?
Mr. Tyler.
Mr. Chair, the premium that was set based on some tweaks to an in-force contract that is being sold at present with our current rates with Medica. And what we did is we tweaked it by 15% according to Medica Finance to include maternity as an illness, and that was a 15% upcharge. And we also included the prescription drug benefit in the major medical benefit. Then the regular Medica Solo plan does not include prescription drug coverage above the first $2,000. So we built that into the major medical as well. So all we did was go to the current census as close as we could estimate. We received more recent information recently to help us more fine-tune that. But all we did is we went to the current level of enrollment based on age brackets and took the rate base with those tweaks and adapted it to give us the final rates on the premiums.
Representative Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Taylor, how does that work going forward? So, the state was contracted with a third-party administrator to pay the premium. Would the state be able to negotiate on the premium, or would we just be on the hook for the premium going forward? I'm thinking about the state.
What we're doing with this is we are bringing in this population into the aggregate overall risk pool of Medica or Blue Cross or Preferred One or Assurance or whomever it is that the enrollee actually elects as far as our carrier is concerned. The idea is to offer people their plans across the board. So we're talking about a really immense risk pool, so this would be pulled into. The renewal rates of this particular plan would be the same as the renewal rates as the risk pools across the board. And so that actually would be a protection rather than this would not be a liability they would be sitting with on their own. It needs to be pulled in. For example, the Blue Cross Blue Shield individual policy risk pool, to my understanding, is in excess of 180,000 participants or more. Just that one carrier alone, which is several times larger than the population we're looking at insuring right now. That really provides a shelter. Do we expect premiums to go? Yes, we do. Yes, we do. I think it's going to be very important to let these carriers underwrite as they need to maintain the integrity of their entire book of business.
What you caught it, Mr. Chair, the costs are going to moderate because of that pooling mechanism. That's very important. We're not doing that right now as a state. We've got these people put in their own pool, many of them unhealthy, and we're not allowing the greater insurance market, some of the healthier people, to help moderate that cost. So I think even though premiums are expected to go up, the healthcare costs are going up in general, mainly due to utilization. You're not going to see the dramatic increases or the increases as a result of a smaller population happening. So I think it actually protects the state more. That's another positive thing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, as a follow-up, if I might. A mathematical calculation, I think that might make sense to you. If the state is currently supporting a $500 per month capitated model, and that, say, changes by 6%, versus if we're supporting a major medical premium that is, say, $220 per month on average, and that changes by 6%. Obviously, there's a big difference in the actual financial upcharge each year, but we're trying to minimize the use of the premium and maximize the use of the HRA to get us to the desired end result, if that helps a little bit.
I think there's some confusion about premium there. You're talking about the state buying this coverage versus the premium that the individual pays.
Yes, an aggregate premium. The aggregate total cost premium.
What the individual would pay would be basically what they pay right now for them.
Correct. That's the idea. Is right now we're not making any changes. We've tossed that back and forth a little bit about what do we do with that. The idea right now is to try to keep everything on an even keel as far as comparison is concerned, not changing that, at least at this point.
Representative Murphy, you have
I just want to make sure I understand. So the transaction between the state and the third party administrator, for instance, would the state be just responsible for paying the cost, whatever the cost is of the coverage as we go forward? Or is there a negotiation between those two parties?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, again, just to help you understand, the third party is for the deductible. They're managing the cash flow to the deductible. So if you recall, we mentioned that the member has a debit card, a Viva card, as we call it. The third party that the department is contracting with administers that cash flow. So the promise to pay of the state, that $2,100 up to $2,100 of eligible expenses, the third party administrator is administering that. The premium we're talking about is the premium for the major medical fees. And that's paid for by the state, and the state is recouping some of that on a sliding fee scale from the members, much like what happens now with what's paid to the health plans, and then members pay a portion of that. So the state has a role to play in determining eligibility, and they're going to have a role to play with that premium piece. But as far as what gets done under the deductible, they're going to do that under a contract with the third-party administrator. And that's another beauty of the plan, is that you derive some administrative cost savings, we think, that we're not booking, by the way, in this. We're not saying that we're going to save the department any or take any money from the department. But these people now are able to walk in with a debit card and get their copay or their deductible covered under that $3,100 up to $2,100 total. So you have the third party managing the money within that deductible, and you've got the premiums being paid by the state and by the members. In fact, I think the department told us it's about $10 million in revenue that they drive off of the sliding fee scale premium payment. So we don't necessarily want to do away with that. The state needs to have that money.
Okay, Representative Bond, and then we're going to...
Thank you.
Open it up to people from the audience.
And good morning, and if I repeat something else, somebody else said sorry, I had to be in another committee meeting for a period of it. To follow up on Representative Murphy, just to be really clear, so my understanding, the answer to her question, she was trying to get at whether the state is ever negotiating about these premiums. I think her answer is no, they're not, that those premiums are being set in the private market when individuals go out there, but the state is establishing a sliding scale, so in fact, we're not negotiating about premiums. At all, and the third party industry is not involved in that, if I understood correctly, and not even, okay. That's not my comment, but I just wanted to clarify that. First of all, I want to thank you for bringing a big idea for me, big ideas going forward here. I also want to thank you that, in a bipartisan way, we're acknowledging that we would like to keep the Health Care Access Commission, fund for its intended purpose to continue covering our Minnesotans on Minnesota care. That this is across both parties, a value of importance to us moving forward, and this is acknowledging that that's an important thing for us to try to keep in our state, something that's been going on for a long time. It's one of the reasons we have such a low redundancy compared to other states. So whatever big ideas we can pursue to accomplish those goals, I think are worth our attention to in a very serious manner and trying to refine and improve going forward. Also, in terms of the biggest issue that are being today, I'm sure was discussed before I came back into the room, is the issue of the assumptions and whether the assumptions are really going to work to make this something that's either cost savings or actually or worth the additional cost if we're getting a better coverage for the Minnesota enrollees. You've been evolving work on that. I think what this project shows as well, though, is that to save money in public programs is a tough task. You're finding that as well. And that in all these areas that we've been working on, that we find that a challenge because obviously people have been working on these things for years and some very bright people as well, both on our staff and in and outside the legislature. So I thank you very much for continuing to work on this and hope that we will continue going forward. These issues we're facing are not going away this session and they're not going away even in the next several years. We'll continue to have to work on this and I'd be glad to continue to work with you on this and other great ideas. So I hope that today and in the next few days, we get further clarification of the assumptions. It's seems like we are. So I'm glad that there's more data coming in. It sounds like we were right in then to address that. Thank you.
Okay. Somebody from the Department of Human Services would like to comment on the fiscal notes. Mr. Hoffman.
Tentative treatment in the fiscal note is that we're going to assume cost neutrality. Not exact cost neutrality, but cost neutrality on a service year basis. My understanding of underwriting is that it's sorts people into groups. It determines whether somebody will be accepted as standard rate. Or will be charged a higher rate, or will be declined coverage. So it sorts people into those groups, and the ones declined coverage are the ones who would go to MSHA. So the question is not just what proportion of the people will go to MSHA, but also what proportion of the claim cost will go to MSHA. I believe the best factual information that we have available is the history of the claim cost of this group of enrollers in Minnesota Care. And the fundamental difference between the capitation model and the individual rating model is that the capitation rate is a group rate. And the individual rate is an individual rate. But if the program has an open-ended obligation for MSHA losses, and the market sets a fairly low rate, let's say the market sets a rate including rating up that gives you charging some people more than the standard rate. Some people, we tentatively agreed on assumptions that 30% would go to MSHA, and that 30% would be charged a higher rate, and that 40% would have a standard rate. Now, from what I've heard this morning, we may not have an agreement on those assumptions anymore, but of the ones who would be accepted for coverage, that would be the 70%, 40% that have a standard rate, 30% that have a higher rate. If those 70%, if for those 70%, we pay a premium which is equal to two-thirds of the expected capitation rate, then we'd be paying two-thirds of 70% of the expected claim cost. Now, two-thirds of 70 is, I should have brought a calculator, 47, 48%. 47%. So on those assumptions, we can pay 47% of the expected cost. Now, on the 30% who go to IMSA, if we take, and we know they're going to cost more for IMSA, if we pay 53% on the 30, if the 30 are not quite twice as expensive as we're, as the capitation rate that we're looking at, we'd be paying more than 50% of the expected cost on the ones going to IMSA. And so that, if it hits 53%, then we're at 100% of the expected cost. 47 on the people expected in the private market, and 53% on the ones going to IMSA. Now, it could cost them some more, but at least in the delete all amendment I get, we have an open-ended commitment to MSHA. We're going to cover MSHA losses. And so I don't see where the savings can come from. We're going to pay higher commercial rates. We're going to pay a lower commercial rate for some people. Other people are going to go to MSHA. Maybe some efficiencies can make up for the higher commercial rates we're going to pay. But I don't see where in that savings can come from. Neither can I find a sufficiently accurate way to say that it's to estimate an additional cost. And so in that sort of situation, I think it's best to be straightforward about this and to say we don't know whether it's going to cost, we don't know whether it's going to save, we're going to assume budget neutrality on a service period basis. Now, there are some cash flow issues which will affect the fiscal note. We will probably pay somewhat sooner under this plan if we pay the month before. On the other hand, if we're going to compensate MSHA losses after the fact, and MSHA can only figure out what we owe them after they have the claims in for a period, so the reimbursement of the MSHA losses is going to come in a following period after the period of coverage. And so I think the cash flow issues roughly are going to balance out. And I think the bottom line of the fiscal note ends up at least across 10 and 11, somewhere close to crossing the balance.
Representative Gottwald,
thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Chair members. This is a very important point. You know, we've been working with Mr. Goffman quite a bit, and I appreciate his help. I appreciate the department's openness. I think we're still in disagreement about some of these issues, but let's just take for a moment his statement about cost neutrality. Now, I disagree, and I think John might have some points to make about why we still think this saves money, but if it doesn't save money, if this is cost neutral, think about everything else that this does. It eliminates cost shifting. It's paying providers commercial rates, hospitals commercial rates, protecting them not at $10,000 inpatient, but $5 million lifetime maximum. It is empowering the enrollees with a debit card. They're no longer going to be treated like second-class citizens on MA rates. They're going to be treated like other commercially insured people. If it does nothing else and is cost neutral, it is going to save the overall health insurance market a ton of money. It's going to help hold down costs. Okay, so if we just buy what George said a moment ago, it's a great plan. All right? Look at everything else it does on balance. And if we can say this is cost neutral, we've just found more than, as Representative Bunn put it, a big idea. We found a big solution. But I, if I could, Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Tyler may want to respond to some of what Mr. Hoffman just said.
Mr. Tyler.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Gottwald, and thank you, Mr. Hoffman. One of the tricky issues that we have struggled with is exactly what Mr. Hoffman referred to, is what does it do to the claims experience or the loss ratios on the MCHA program. And we did have a good meeting with the MCHA president asking about the nature of the claims that are incurred there. And, you know, we did go either way. And one thing we did assume in our calculations was that the overall loss ratio of the people that go into MCHA from the Minnesota care population has the same loss ratio as is currently being incurred. That would be, I think, a realistically or even somewhat pessimistic perspective, but we needed to incorporate that. So our calculations as far as projected savings does incorporate that into the overall calculations. One interesting piece of information that was gleaned was that in the current roughly 28,000 number at 20 MCHA enrollment, 3% of the enrollees drive 45% of the claims. That might very well be the case with the new enrollees coming in from Minnesota Care. It could very well be the case. But it also could be that if you bring in, for example, 10 or 15,000 new enrollees to further enhance the size of the MCHA, and they don't fit that mold, they're not that sick, that 3% is not driving 45% of the new enrollees, it could actually gather a larger premium base that can help stabilize that. In addition, the MCHA 2.42% surcharge, premium surcharge, would apply to premiums of the individuals purchasing private coverage, which also helps to sustain the MCHA as well. And so we have members of a publicly funded program now contributing to the MCHA plan that the public fund is actually using. The other perspective of this, which is not, I don't think should be discounted or lost, is that as we alluded to before, we're trying to reduce the rate of increase of the rate of increase as far as the cost is concerned. So we are trying to, we have a 6% premium across the board increase of a $220 average premium versus a $500 average premium. The actual cost increase has been cut in half, or more than cut in half as well, to the state. Just by, even if we assume the same rate of increase, if it's on a smaller number, it reduces the overall cost of the increase as well. So we're trying to accomplish a couple of things with this analysis.
Mr. Tyler, when you someone applies in an individual market, you evaluate their health. That's what the underwriting is. You then just say, no, we don't want to insure you, or do you adjust the premium based on what you think they're going to cost?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Depending upon the carrier we're talking about, some carriers, there are two carriers in state that may adjust for risk. They, for example, will accept you for a 5% surcharge or a 10% surcharge. That is a possibility to two of the carriers. Others do not. Either accept or decline type of situation. If it's a situation where an individual is declined outright by a black or white carrier, then it's not unusual to apply to a secondary carrier who is able to look at it differently. One of those criteria is tobacco use, for example. Some carriers will automatically rate up for tobacco use by 20, 30, 40% depending upon the carrier. Others will say, well, no, how much tobacco use? And it might only be a 5% adjustment or a 10% adjustment. If it's just a social tobacco user to use tobacco on the weekends or whatever, is not rated the same way. So it gives us quite a bit of latitude there. So in our assumptions, we're assuming an accept or decline situation. If we do get people that are able to apply and have a substandard or a substandard or maybe a slight rate up, but it's less than the 20% rate up of MCHA, we have actually saved the difference in that by getting a rate up. So it just depends on the carrier general. We assume that tobacco use was for 30% of the population. And then we further assume a 40% rate up of that 30% rate up of the population as well. So I'm not really looking at the possibility of improving. So I think we've been intentionally pessimistic about it with our analysis, not really quite knowing what we're going to get. But there is some latitude there in underwriting that could mean better rates than we're actually assuming.
Mr. Chair, we may want to get to other testifiers at this point. I know I want to be sensitive to the time.
Okay. Well, let's, anybody else? Representative Hershey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, while Mr. Hoffman is here. And this might be a question you need to get some information on, but I'm wondering, within Minnesota Care today,
How many of the enrollees on an annual basis max on that hospitalization cap? So, do you have a sense of the annual number of people that go beyond that $10,000 cap?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, I don't know that offhand. I can get some information on it.
That is very helpful.
What we're doing, what is happening in this plan is basically you would be swapping the $10,000 hospital cap for the $1,000 deductible that the individual incurs after they go through the $2,100 HRA value.
And then, Mr. Chair, just one quick follow-up. This is a guaranteed issue because of MSHA, if I understand that correctly. So if, you know, you present and get enrolled in one of these self-insured plans, and then you have a big event, in the next year, could you be sent then to MSHA, or do you stay in the insurance until you hold your $5 million?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that's a great question. That's one of the things to really highlight and tout about the state of Minnesota. It's a guaranteed renewable contract. The only real things that we see people having their coverage rescinded on is for fraud. You know, for health people's health changes indefinitely or perpetually, I think. I'm sorry. And the once you have your contract and it's been legally and officially obtained, you keep that, you know, regardless of your health conditions, until you, as the insurer, decide to cancel it. So it's a really very important difference. And I'm not sure that's necessarily the case in every state, but it is the case here in Minnesota.
Okay, we're going to have to move on. If anybody, is there somebody from the health plans that wishes to comment? Okay, anybody else wish to? There's somebody in the back. You welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
Good morning. My name is David Allen. I'm here representing the Minnesota Physician Patient Alliance. MPPA is a nonpartisan, not-for-profit organization that's been around since, I believe, 1994. And we are committed as an organization to accessible, universally accessible, quality, affordable care. And we're comprised, we think of ourselves as a think tank of physicians, healthcare administrators, and patients, which you might just broadly label as wonks, health policy wonks, and we try to educate and increase awareness about healthcare reform initiatives. Personally, I've been a healthcare executive and consultant for over 30 years. We have reviewed HF 1865, and we are very enthusiastic supporters. And I'd like to just briefly summarize why. First, we think it's great for patients. We believe that paying commercial rates rather than second-class MA rates is going to dramatically increase the access to the insured population, to physicians throughout the state. We think that the benefit of $5 million lifetime rather than $10,000 per year is a very substantial increase and improvement to the health benefits coverage. We also believe that there is an opportunity to expand the coverage to areas like vision and dental, which we think is very beneficial. A second reason that we are supporters is we think this is very beneficial to physicians. Right now, it is a sacrifice for physicians and other healthcare providers to see MA patients, and it is also problematic collecting the copays, and it's expensive filing the claims associated with the Minnesota Care Program. This program makes it much more efficient for doctors, and it pays them a fair and reasonable rate. Thirdly, we are supportive of this because we believe it benefits the state and the people of Minnesota. I listened to the testimony, and I will try to add to whether or not this will save the state money directly. But I would like to offer the perspective that it does save money at the doctor and patient level in a couple of ways. First, as I mentioned, the administrative costs are much lower. There are studies that have been done that estimate in the United States as a whole that we spend something like a quarter to a third of all of the money we spend on healthcare goes into overhead and administration. Much of that, most of that, is due to the fact that we process claims on every individual service. So doctors and hospitals have extensive billing and collection staff. The insurance company or the government program have staff and employees, and there are a lot of expenses associated with that. That dramatically increases the cost. That is a cost that is reflected in the current Minnesota Care program. But in this program, there is a debit card that will be just swiped, and we will have much lower transaction costs. There won't be the impediment of trying to collect co-pays in most cases, because you just swipe the debit card and it pays the co-pay for you. So that's one category of savings that will be real and will really lower the cost of 1865 versus current Minnesota care. An even bigger area is that it's going to change the way patients and doctors get their medical care. Under the current Minnesota Care program, there's a copay, and we're talking about poor people, people with low-income people, people with incomes of less than 250% of federal poverty level. And these people care about their copayments, and so they delay going into seeing the doctor when they're not feeling well. And if they have a chronic condition, which a lot of the people who have high expenses and are at high risk for hospitalization have chronic conditions. They have hypertension or diabetes, or they're pre-diabetic, or they have anemia, or they have a chronic disease like multiple sclerosis. And those people, every time they want to go see the doctor under the current system, they delay. And from the doctor's perspective, the doctor is looking at low reimbursement, perhaps reimbursement that doesn't even cover his or her own time, but just covers the cost of the office being open. And that, so they don't want to encourage people to come back for their regular visits. We're getting rid of that antiquated, obsolete approach to covering health care and replacing it with a much more progressive approach. And we are saying, you have a debit card, and your objective is to live within the $2,100 HRA, and as long as you're within that $2,100, there's no cost to you. So it makes much more sense to go in and take care of that problem before it gets to be worse. It makes much more sense to follow up on it on a regular basis. This is a very significant improvement to the cost effectiveness of healthcare by implementing this plan. And I guess the final point I want to make as to why this is a benefit, we think, to the state of Minnesota and Minnesotans, is that it is eliminating the problem of cost shifting, at least for this 55,000 people. If we are paying full commercial rates, we don't have the problem of increasing the cost of other of people who are already covered under commercial rates, which is what happens now with Minnesota Care. And that is a big problem for the number of people who have insurance in Minnesota and for the cost of those who do have insurance in Minnesota. Is cost shifting from public programs which are not reimbursing providers at commercial rates. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Is there, well, we're going to have to move right along because we have another bill to do and we only have 25 minutes.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 1865. My name is Maureen O'Connell and I'm with Legal Aid. Legal Aid represents low-income persons throughout Minnesota on health care issues. And I'll make my testimony brief this morning, but first I'd like to thank Representative Gottwald and his colleagues for all the time and effort they have put into this proposal. I'd also like to thank Representative Gottwald for including Legal Aid in the discussion. As recently as Friday, we spent 2 hours with representatives from the Underwriters Association coming to a better understanding of how the plan would work for Minnesota care enrollees. Our analysis is really focused on what is the risk to the enrollees under the plan. And as the last testifier said, you know, our concern is that this is a population with very limited income. And what we also know from many of the Minnesota Care clients that we see in our office is that, you know, we think there are several populations in Minnesota Care, but all of the people in Minnesota Care are doing the right thing in that they value health care enough that they are willing to pay premiums even though they don't get it through their employer. And we also know that many of them are at incomes where they're struggling, you know, to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, afford transportation to work, and pay premium. So one of our interests really, as we looked at it from an enrollee standpoint, was the trade-off that George has talked about. Removing the 10,000 inpatient cap and essentially the risk to the enrollee of whether they're going to get to the $1,000 deductible. And this was and so we really appreciated when we thought that the DeLeo amendment took away the premium for the enrollees, which now based on the testimony this morning I'm not so sure, because that really was alleviating some of our affordability issues. And so we are concerned. We think that $2,100 is not a lot in today's healthcare market. One can get through $2,100 of coverage fairly quickly. If anybody has been involved in the healthcare system recently, they know that. So under our analysis, you know, as the question Representative Murphy asked is a very important one to us, is how many people are currently on Minnesota Care are reaching that $10,000 limit? And, you know, and then correspondingly, what are the estimates of the number of people that would get to the $1,000 deductible? And so we'd really like to see that data. You know, but we have been interested. We also know our clients, you know, if this can provide them with better coverage and pay commercial rates, we know the rate issue affects access. And so it's why we have been so interested in trying to figure out how would this work for clients. And so we see every day how our clients struggle with medical debt. So if we thought, if under this plan we could fix their cost, that would be a good thing for clients too. I mean, if we, you know, as opposed to the inpatient hospital cap, where if you reach it at 10,000, then you have kind of unlimited liability. You know, it appeals to us the idea of being able to say to a group of low-income Minnesotans, this is what you could expect to pay for health care in a year, you know, $500 or $1,000. So we have been talking to Representative Gottwald about possibly reducing that $1,000 to more of a sliding scale, too. So the Delete All Amendment addresses some of our concerns. My final note would be that we just have been pushing for more specificity in the bill regarding the benefit set and the cost-sharing arrangements. As we've studied it, and I know that Representative Gottwald is also open to this, as we studied it, you know, we still are very concerned about the mental health coverage and the prescription drug coverage, because most major medicals, as we've been looking at them, there's a calendar year maximum on prescription drug coverage of $2,000. And so, and we're not sure if that's a part of this or not. So we think specificity on the benefits that and cost-sharing arrangements in the bill would give us a great deal of comfort going forward. And then the other thing that we have recently been, we think needs further analysis, is just how well would the enrollees that are shifted to IMCHA, how well would the benefit plan, because the bill calls for them to have the identical coverage. And again, if it has a, if the prescription drug plan has a $2,000 calendar cap, then we are very concerned about how that would affect them, the people that are shifted to IMCHA.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. O'Connell. And we're going to have to move on, so Representative Gottwald, you got about 30 seconds.
Mr. Chair, I won't add much to that, but I would encourage the committee and anybody else that's listening, this is more than just a big idea or a good idea. I think this is something that we need to work into what we're doing for the sake of, for all the reasons that we give. There's no hidden agenda here. I think we found something that can work. I think we've shown it for some of its toughest critics. I think been amazed to see that it actually does work. And I think we ought to try it. I think this $55,000 is a great place to start. And to show that it works, if there's a need to tweak it a bit, we can do that with this population and then begin using this model to provide better coverage, better payment to providers, and better access to quality care for enrollees. And start doing it now. We haven't got a lot of time to waste in figuring out these better solutions to things.
This was billed as an informational hearing on this bill, and I think we got a lot of information, and obviously there's some questions left, but even if we didn't save any money on the state budget, if we were paying providers more, what they ought to get paid, then that's a tremendous change. So I want to thank you for all your work, and we'll be discussing this again. And now we have to go to Representative.
Thank you for your time.
And, I'll call the meeting to order. We have a host? Which one?
No, I don't think we do.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the minutes from April 29th. Representative Murphy moves the minutes from April 29th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. The minutes are adopted. Representative Osh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the committee's patience on this bill last week. We tried it here two separate times. I have some records that you've seen just before. Health File 1708 is the department's mental health policy bill. Generally, there is no cost, but it is before the committee because of an amendment that was adopted in health policy that I'm going to address with an oral amendment. But, Mr. Chair, at this time, before the committee is in A1 and the A4 amendment that I would like to have.
So, Representative Haas moves House File 1708. And then he moves the A1 amendment.
And Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment is an amendment from the department in which they have been working with marriage and family therapists, the Minnesota Council of Child Care Agencies, and has been clarifying language to make sure that some of the provisions, further provisions in this bill, do not have unintended consequences.
Any discussion, Representative Kiffmeyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think in including, if I understand correct, on your A1 amendment on second page up there, we are adding a new category, behavioral health aid, directly supervised on site. That's good. Does that change the cost structure? I mean, is that what you're referring to as the fiscal note possibility there? Is that where you're referring to why it's coming here? Is that where the source of the fiscal note is, or is there a fiscal note?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, I'm looking at the amendment. I don't think it adds a new behavioral health aid. We already have that in statute of behavioral health aid 1, behavioral health aid 2. I think this just provides some clarification in what they can do in some children's therapeutic services and support, and also how we're supervised. The fiscal note is actually in section 18 of this bill, and I will be addressing that with the oral amendment.
Okay. Any further discussion of the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So we have the A1 amendment. Now the is it A13?
A4.
A4, I want to see. I move to the A4 amendment.
And Mr. Chair, the A4 amendment allows mental health practitioners who are behavioral aids 1 or 2 to have some of the hours within the certain mental health services to be covered for 6,000 hours for becoming a mental health practitioner. And this is supported by the National Association of Mental Illness, and it is supported by the department.
Any discussion? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rush, is there anybody that doesn't support it that you're aware of?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, no.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to get again because of the change on the fiscal note. So this A4 amendment is the one that removes any potential cost change on this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, that deals with Section 18 of this bill, and I'll be doing that.
Okay, all those in favor of the A4 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So we now adopted the two amendments. Representative Hodge.
Mr. Chair, my last oral amendment, then we can have the department come up and do a synopsis of the bill, deals with rate setting. We adopted an amendment in health policy that the commissioner would have to report back to the committees of jurisdiction of rate setting methodology for IRFs and for IRF providers. The department said we have a fiscal cost to it. So instead, what I would like to do, Mr. Chair, is, and I apologize for the oral amendment, but I think this will address some of the concerns, but on line 22.15, strike, recommend, and insert, implement. And then on line 22.16, after services, insert starting January 1st, 2010.
Could you repeat that?
On line 22.16, after services, insert starting January 1st, 2010. And then to take the fiscal components out of this, is just to report to the committees, I would then strike the language in the bill after services, all the way through line 22.18 to the period. So essentially it would read, the commissioner shall implement a new statewide rate setting methodology for intensive residential and non-residential mental health services starting January 1st, 2010. Then it would go into the new rate setting methodology shall be fiscally neutral, so on and so forth.
Okay, so Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Hosh, I can understand how making the rate setting neutral takes away a fiscal piece, but it still is a requirement for the department to engage in an activity So do they not still have a fiscal cost? I'm just trying to understand how it takes the fiscal matters away.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, the department's original language that was in the original bill had this fiscally neutral component in it. The department generally would like to have this rate setting methodology implemented right away because for some clarification matters for the intensive residential treatment individuals. I would like to see a continued engagement of the providers in this rate setting methodology. So this is a general compromise at this point, and the department indicated that the fiscal cost is going to be the report back to the committees and to the chairs. And this is, at this point, I think a compromise that I will continue to work on between the department and the providers as we move forward. I'm assuming that this probably isn't going to be the last form, but we're getting closer to an area in which everybody can agree.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Rod.
We don't have much time. So I'm just curious, Representative Hosh, how do you plan on moving forward? And how do you, I mean, what is the plan for continued discussion? We already have unfortunately, a policy bill that is now going to have to run through rules and kind of skip the process a little bit. So I'm just trying to understand how we move forward.
Representative Hosh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, my plan is that in the next hearing, that we will change the effective date of this to a more immediate time, but clarify that the rate setting methodology that is established is not retroactive to past year investments. And that's part of the concern.
Okay, so Representative Hosh has an oral amendment which relates to Representative Pittmeyer.
Thank you. And in noticing the, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate the situation of where you're coming from, but again, just to make sure, on line 2220, it says in developing the recommendations, that whole sentence from 2218 down to the end, that is still in place. But it also has the word recommendations. Is that, could you give an oral up above? I just wanted to be sure. Could you start recommend and put implement there? Is there any need for something in line 2220?
Representative
Hodge. Mr. Chair, Representative Pittmeyer, I think you have a good point, and I would also include in the oral amendment the strike recommendation on 2220 and insert the rate setting methodology. But, well, that's kind of duplicative, Mr. Chair. I would just strike in developing the recommendations. That's it.
Well, Representative Hodgson, then you have to start a sentence with four. Okay, that would work. So, Representative Hodge moves on line 2215, strike the word recommend and insert implement. And on line 2216, after the word services, insert starting January 1, 2010, a period there, and then strike the rest of 2216, all of 2217, and 2218 through the period. And then on line 2220, strike in developing the recommendations, and then so strike that, and then the sentence would start with the word four. It has to be capitalized.
Yeah. I think the advisories.
Yeah. So, any discussion of that?
Well,
Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if that last sentence makes a lot of sense just by striking that first clause. Maybe you want to strike the four. And the commissioner on the next line. I just think we should take another look at how that reads.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I greatly apologize for this. So instead of striking in developing the recommendations, let's strike instead the recommendations for it. So it would read in developing the new rate setting methodology with the commission.
Okay. Okay, so on line 2220, modifies his amendment, so we strike recommendations four, and then we would have to strike the V there as well, I think. There's two of these. Before I get more confused, any other discussion? But let's vote on the Ahasha Earl Amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So, you now have your bill the way you want it, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Department of Human Services policy mental health bill. It's generally budget neutral, especially after the last oral amendment. It codifies many of the existing policies and practices that the Department of Human Services generally participates in already. It deals with three primary areas: adult mental health rehabilitation services, mainly with technical amendments, community health worker supervision, as you saw in one of the amendments, and then also children's mental health, including CTSS services. I will allow the department and Mr. Cox to address some of the details or the section by section analysis or section by section.
You're going to have to be very brief because we're both at the end here.
Mr. Chair, we've been here, but yes, I can be brief. I'm Gary Cox with the Children's Mental Health Division at the Department of Human Services. Everything I'm going to be talking about has to do with the Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports and the Children's Rehabilitation Option Services. There is no fiscal note on any of these items. There are a couple of items that have some fiscal efficiencies. There are no direct relation to the state budget, but are of some use to providers. In section 10.18, the skills training language actually puts makes CTSS skills training language, it codifies what this is current practice and makes the language consistent with federal Medicaid standards, which reduces some financial and audit risks for providers and the state. I'm just going to touch briefly on the ones that have any fiscal implications at all. In section 12, there's some language that eliminates local certification of CPSS providers that would streamline the CPSS certification process and eliminate a county mandate for local participation in the certification process. In section 13, it deletes amendment coordination mandate. There are two other places in statute where this type of coordination is required, so this would eliminate certification of the mandates. In section 14, that's addressed one of the author's amendments, and that cleans up some of the language about treatment plans and clinical supervisors. In section 16, another item is addressed by the author's amendment, D1, increases flexibility for day treatment programs to providers. Day treatment programs are currently struggling to survive right now, and this would increase the flexibility available to them, and in particular, it reduces the minimum program requirements for day treatment to 2 hours per day. In section 16, the mental health behavioral aid language essentially clarifies what a mental health behavioral aid does. There's been a lot of confusion about what behavioral aid does right now. In this current law, it looks a lot like what a PCA does. This makes it clear that mental health behavioral aids are a part of the mental health treatment.
financing activities so that we comply with the federal rehab option requirements and reduce a lot of risk.
There's probably one other section that does have some fiscal implications, not to the state, but to counties in a positive manner. As you saw before, there's some mandate reduction for Section 2 also eliminates the requirements for counties to complete a level of care determination for a child who is admitted into an acute care hospital. The hospital already does this, so it was redundant, and that mandate is strictly the scope as well.
Any questions? Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to make sure that this new language doesn't restrict or put any limitations on the provision or the services provided to children with autism.
No,
there's no restrictions, no additional limitations, nothing like that in the bill for the department.
Mr. Chairman, this language codifies existing practices. We don't anticipate that there will be any change in what providers are currently going for and a lot of the adult policies. It either expands the benefit or constricts the benefit.
Mr. Chairman, part of the reason I'm asking is when you say we're codifying ourselves to the federal law, is what I heard you originally say, we tend to go above and beyond the federal law, and so my concern is if we're going back to the federal law, I want to have it as clear as I can that we're not going to be putting additional limitations. And part of the reason it's important is that we've been talking also about the fact that we are going to be through a mandate discussion that we have. We're going to be requiring the private plans to do certain things and not allow them to have any limitations. And so I just want to make sure that if we're going to be doing that with the private market, the state is not exempting ourselves out. We've done that a number of times with different provisions, whether it's requiring plans to provide health care to kids up until age 25, yet we exempted out the PDIA plan from that. And so I just want to make sure that we're not disaligning ourselves with the private market.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, in this case, I understand what you're saying about going back to federal standards. In this case, it's a different situation. We're not going back to federal standards in the sense that, in any sense of contracting the benefit. But what we have in CTSS statute right now, both in the skills training area and in the mental health behavioral aid area, is language in current law that looks an awful lot like personal care assistance, PCA. It doesn't really address the fact that both of these services are mental health treatment services. There is vague language. I think, you know, the department essentially didn't do a very good job of drafting these sections when this language was enacted in 2003. And this just makes it clear that both skills training and behavioral aids are mental health treatment services that must be available, you know, that are meant to remediate the child's mental illness. It's not something as broad and nebulous as personal care assistance.
Representative Kiffmeyer, do you have
a... No,
Mr. Chairman. Okay, Representative Haas, is there... Is that it? Okay, all those in favor are... Representative Hosh moves 1708 as amended that it be recommended to pass and return to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passed to the Finance Committee. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.